All right. Welcome, everybody, to the Glenel Marine Designs teleseminar. This is Gail Brantek. I am the Vice President of Glenel Marine Designs, and I'm happy to introduce you tonight to Carl Puhl, who is also known as 50 Plus on our Boat Builder Forum. And he's going to be telling us tonight about how to wire your boat and install a hydraulic steering system. So welcome, Carl. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Well, let's start first off. We're going to talk a little bit about, I'm going to ask a few background questions of Carl, and then we'll get right into the subject because I know he's got a lot to share. You might want to have a paper and pen available so you can take notes because I'm sure it's going to be just riveting, huh, Carl?
Oh, you bet.
Okay, well, first off, you're calling from Saginaw, Michigan, right?
That is correct.
All right. Now, tell me, you've obviously built some boats, so tell me which boats you've built.
Well, the first boats I built, like when I was 10, 11 years old, were out of cast-off dock lumber from other people where my dad had his cottage. They obviously all sunk. And the first thing that I really built was a kit boat when I was 15, which was, I believe, sold by the Clark Craft Boat Company, and it was a 14-foot bay sailor.
Oh, okay.
And then the next one was the LaChat Glenel Design 16-foot catamaran.
Okay.
And then after that, I built a small dinghy. I do not remember. It was an 8-foot pram type, who the designer was. Mm-hmm. And then I built a Mini Most or Mini Max. I don't remember which.
Okay.
And then there was this one, the 50 Plus, which is a Ted Brewer design.
That's a Ted Brewer.
Type.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what design? It's a 50-foot boat.
No, 37.
37.
Yeah, the name's 50.
It was close, wasn't it?
Yeah.
37-foot boat. And it's built out of plywood?
That is correct. Traditional plywood on frame construction.
Okay. What is the design name that Ted Brewer gave it?
That was Quiet Times.
Quiet Times. Okay, because mm-hmm. I know somebody had already asked about that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what do you do as a profession, Carl?
Well, I do service and repair work. And to give you a good generic name for it, I do handyman things. So.
Okay. All right. And did you, this one question I had where I got the acronym wrong, did you follow, what rules did you follow for wiring your boat?
Well, everybody talks about the American Boat and Yacht Council, ABYC standards, mm-hmm. which is a group that tries to set good practices in not only in doing it, but in materials and they do that for all aspects, boating, tides, the wiring. So,
okay.
But the real stuff that counts is in the Code of Federal Regulations, Section 183. And you can find that at USG. Boy, now I can see that. USCGBoating.org. And they have lots of information of the CFR, Code of Federal Regulations, and the Section 183 covers all kinds of things besides wiring.
Okay.
And then for reference, you might want to look at Boat Owner's Illustrated Handbook of Wiring by Charlie Wing.
Okay.
And the Marine Electrical and Electronics Bible by John C. Payne. And also the Boat Owner's Mechanical and Electrical Manual by Nigel Calder.
Okay.
There's a lot of good stuff in all of that. So.
But okay.
The main thing is when push comes to shove, if it's coming down to a legal question, you go with the Code of Federal Regulations because mm-hmm. that's stuff that really counts. But
right.
By and large, most of that stuff has been adopted into the American Boat and Yacht Council standards. So.
Okay. Well, do you have kind of a general idea of the cost of wiring a boat? I know you have your 37-foot.
Well, to tell you the truth, when I bought most of my material in 2004 and 5, it was 20% of the cost of what it is now.
Okay.
So that makes it very difficult. But the main thing with wiring is that it is really boat specific and what you choose for equipment.
Okay.
And I mean merely moving the battery 10 feet to help with balance or whatever will cost you quite a bit more money,
mm-hmm.
just for the wire in order to do it properly. So it's really, really difficult until you've laid it out accurately and decided what all is going to be in there to kind of guess what it's going to cost.
Okay.
Merely moving the battery 10 feet to help with balance.
Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Well, cost you quite a bit.
We're getting some kind of a feedback. Okay. Hopefully that will stop.
Yeah.
Well, how about the steering? Do you have an idea of what the steering cost you?
What it cost me,
yeah.
to do it on my boat. I think that with just the steering system itself, not counting the autopilot, I have about $1,400 in the component.
Okay.
So right. that's the hydraulic pump at the helm and the cylinder at the tiller and the connecting tubings and fitting.
Okay. Now, you also chose a hydraulic steering as opposed to like push-pull or rotary. Why would that be?
Well, the main reason for me was priority was to have a good working autopilot. So
okay.
hydraulic is a lot easier and cheaper to make work well with an autopilot than the other systems. But
okay.
the other really big factor is that my steering station is 30 feet from the rudder. So by the time you added all of the footage in there, you probably would have had to have a 37 or 38 foot push-pull cable, and the friction would have been horrible.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
wouldn't have worked out so well. It could have been done with cables and pulleys, but boy, you'd have had to really cut the boat up to get, you know, passage for all that stuff. So.
Yeah. Okay. Now, your screen name on our boat builder forum is 50 Plus.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the name of your boat. How'd you
yep.
come up with that?
Well, probably about a year into the build, we started writing down names. And after I'd been building for 3 years, we could not come to an agreement on a name for
okay.
the boat. So one day, either wife or I was going over the stuff we had written down and said, you know, there's 50-plus names here.
Ah, okay.
So that's how we ended up with that name.
Okay. I thought it was maybe because you were over 50 years old, but okay.
Well, that applies, and the design of the boat is supposed to look 50 years old, but that's not why we named it that.
Okay, that's a good idea. I like that. Okay. All right, well, why don't you go ahead and get started? Tell us, you got your boat built. Now start with your wiring. Just tell us, oh, master.
Oh, boy. Well, when you turn it over, there's always that shock of, now what am I going to do with an empty hull?
Uh-huh.
And one of the big things that you need to have in the back of your mind right from that moment is exactly what equipment you're going to have in there and what you're going to put it in and where. And while you're building your interior, whether it's just seats or the cabin, you have to keep that in mind so that you'll have places to run wire chases and get your wiring to all your needed equipment. So, and, you know, you may have a VHF radio, a stereo, but you also have horn and windshield wiper and running lights and a blower and a bilge pump. So you can have lots of things that you need to wire in there. So
mm-hmm.
you have to keep that in mind because if you just build the boat, all the wood part like you want it, and then go to add the wiring later, you can end up having to cut through an awful lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing you don't want to do is add extra wire. So to get around things, you want to have the most direct and concise runs that you can have.
Okay.
So then after you've kept that in mind while you're building, you're going to decide if you're going to have, usually you have, even in a small boat, a main panel location somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to pick that out. So, and then the next big thing would be to decide where your battery's going to be located.
Okay.
So then after you get those two done, then you need to have some way to figure out where you're going to run everything. And I happen to have a roll of blue string and a roll of red string, and I used one for the 12-volt system and one for the 120-volt system.
Mm-hmm.
So I would run string from the panel location and tape it along the boat and get it to where the device I wanted to wire was located.
Mm-hmm.
So I ran all of that to make sure that it would run properly and that you could get some idea of the actual footage of the wire you would need. So,
good idea.
Yeah. And I guess here's where we really need to talk about wire quite a bit, because when you're going to, say, run a bilge pump and it's going to draw 10 amps and it's 12 feet or 18 feet, whatever, from your panel, in order to have wire that's big enough to deliver the amperage you need at the voltage you need, you have to know the total accurate distance. So you can't just say it's 10 feet from there. You need, if it's 14 feet, then you have to know that pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to double that distance because electricity travels to your device and back from your device. So if it's 14 feet away from the main panel, then that's a 28-foot round trip.
Okay.
So then you have, I like to use Blue Seas Systems panels, and I used a lot of Anchor wire and their products that enable you to wire.
Mm-hmm.
And they have charts, and you can also find the charts in the ABYC standards that will list the size wire you need for the distance you're going.
Okay.
So you look up on the chart, I'm going to run 28 feet, and I need 10 amps of electricity at 12 volts. And ABYC recommends that you have no more than a 3% voltage drop. So they have both a 10% and a 3%. But I adhered to the 3% for all of my stuff. And so then that gives you a gauge of wire to run, and that's how you determine exactly what you need for wire. I ran a minimum of 14 gauge to anything because I didn't want to run anything smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And the main reason for that is that virtually everything you have that's electrical that runs on 12 volts runs much better the closer it is being delivered its 12-volt electricity.
Okay.
So if you lose 10%, it's not going to work as well. And then especially for pumps and that, they don't pump as much.
Mm-hmm.
And your radio may not put out as good a signal. And if you want to use it in an emergency, that sometimes can be, you know, a safety issue. So
Okay. That's
why you spend so much time measuring things and then looking them up on the charts and make sure you've got it correct. One thing I might say about the ABYC standard is that you can purchase those, but they're very pricey.
Mm-hmm.
But companies like like Blue Sea System have quite a bit of that regulation printed on as a resource on their website.
Okay.
So you can look up a lot of those things. And the companies do have engineers that you can call and talk to. So if you have specific problems about how to hook up their products, why, they can give you some help with that.
Oh, good.
Okay. So we've measured and we've been.
So it really takes a lot of forethought, doesn't it? And a lot of
absolutely.
Thinking as you're building, and then mm-hmm. once you get it done, then just really planning.
Right. After you've decided where it's going to run, then you really have to pay attention to all the details if you want your stuff to work properly and stay working properly.
Yeah.
You know, and I've had used boats over the years, and that's always been the worst part is some weird wiring stuff that was done by somebody who didn't do it right, and you're out on the water and something quits working.
Yeah.
Whether it's the radio or the stereo or the bilge pump, it's always at an inconvenient time. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, for people who are building boats with cabins, or you could do it even in a runabout, if you need to run wire where you think it's going to have to be out in the open, you can make a wood wire chase. I used a lot of 3/4 by 7/8 mahogany, and I would route a groove in the back that would accept the wire,
mm-hmm.
and then round the top corners off. And you can screw that to any surface and run your wire through there.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so that works out good. And then a lot of the specifications for running wires are also listed in the regulations, because you want your wires supported, you know, roughly every foot or so with a rubber insulated metal clip or nylon wire clips that you can screw on so that the wire does not flop around and is is held in place.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing I might mention here is that you can put what's called a split loom, which kind of looks like a little miniature corrugated black pipe, and it has a split down the side, and you can put that over your wire for extra protection. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to use that, you should make sure the one that you're buying is rated as self-extinguishing. And if you're making multiple runs of wire in fore and aft of your boat or crosswise, don't run one wire with its hold-down devices and then add four or five to it by adding cable ties to bundle them all together. One of the problems with wiring is that you don't want it to overheat.
Mm-hmm.
So if you bundle them all together tightly, that in an odd set of circumstances could cause some overheating and some issues there.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Mike mentioned about batteries, as my entire 37-foot battery runs on 2 6-volt golf cart batteries.
Oh.
And we can anchor out for approximately 35 to 40 hours with no other battery source. And it runs the refrigerator and the lights and the pumps.
Oh, very good.
And they recharge and cycle nicely, and they're quite cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to some of the other more exotic, those are wet cell lead acid batteries.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that's really nice for them is that Blue Seas makes the box that fits them perfectly, that meets all the ABYS standards.
Oh, good.
ABYC standards, yes. And that may be important to your insurance people.
Okay.
You know, if you make you get the boat surveyed. And I guess I probably should mention battery chargers. I kind of like the Charles 3-stage battery chargers, because they give battery its proper 3-stage charge.
Mm-hmm.
You get a fully charged, and they'll charge up to 3 banks of batteries. And they also can be set for a wet cell battery, a gel cell battery, or the mat batteries.
Mm-hmm.
And if you need cabin lights, they're really efficient. I might mention the Alpenglow Light Company. You can find them on the internet. They're in Utah or someplace like that, where a lot of people have need for lights to run off batteries because they're not online with electricity. So,
say that again. What lights were those?
Those are Alpenglow lights.
How do you spell that?
A-L-P-E-N and then G-L-O-W.
Okay.
Alpenglow. And the thing that I found remarkable is that they make a wood frame on it to your specification. And I told him I had mahogany interior in my boat, and he mm-hmm. asked what color it was, and we decided it was medium red for what he thought. And when I got them, boy, they matched very, very closely.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. I will tell you a little about them is that they are a fluorescent fixture that is color-corrected to incandescent. So you get the efficiency of fluorescent, but more like the color of an incandescent bulb.
Okay.
And they have 2 light levels on that. And I ordered the ones that also have red LED lights mm-hmm. so that you can have cabin lights on while you're running at night and you don't lose your night vision. You can turn on the red light and you can still see to move around. And the red LEDs burn virtually no electricity. The one remarkable fact about the Alpenglow lights, if you run their regular light, the white fluorescent, you can run 4 of those on the same amount of electricity that you burn in 1 bayonet-based typical RV or boat ceiling light.
Oh.
So they're very, very efficient.
Yeah.
And if you're trying to save electricity, you might go for some Aqua Signal navigation lights. They do have LED lights. And for people that have shore power, I have had very good luck with Marinco stainless steel receptacles, and then their cable sets have been pretty good quality. So I suppose I should mention some more about wire.
Okay.
Because a lot of people want to use an automotive wire, or they want to use a marine wire, but there are different grades of marine wire. The best marine wire has insulation that's rated at 105 degrees, and typically Anchor makes most of that stuff. There are some other companies that'll make it, and it's very, very flexible and easy to use compared to some of the the lesser quality wires.
Mm-hmm.
And marine wire is American wire gauge rather than SAE gauge, which is what they use for cars.
Okay.
And the American wire gauge is about 5 to 10% larger in diameter than the SAE gauge. So therefore, it will deliver better voltage to whatever you're using for the gauge size.
Okay.
And they make a type 2 and type 3 marine wire. And these are highly stranded, and they're all the strands are tinned copper. Some people like to try and use welding cable for their battery cables. That's, you know, highly stranded copper cable, but it's not tinned. And corrosion does get into those pretty fast.
Okay.
But the thing about the type 3 wire versus type 2 is it has 5 to 10 times more strands than type 2. So if you get into a big battery cable, it can have like 2,500 strands in it. So they're very fine wire, and the reason for that being that fine is that it can be bent and wiggle and vibrate many, many more times before it fatigues and breaks. The fewer conductors you have in your cable, the stiffer and the more readily it will bend the conductors until they break. So, and then I guess we should mention that because I like all tinned copper wire, I also was pretty careful to stick to Anchor products for their spades, ring, and snap terminals. And those are the devices that are put on the ends of the wire, regardless of gauge, that you're going to use. And all of their stuff is tinned copper, which is much better than brass. I will mention about Blue Sea systems for their main panels and their battery switches and their bus bars, all of those kinds of things you would use in your wiring.
Mm-hmm.
They are copper, that is tin plate, whereas a lot of other companies use brass, you know, or they're copper and they're not tin plated. So if you want stuff that's really going to last,
mm-hmm.
that's what you're looking for, is tin plated copper.
Okay.
From the conductors to the devices. And then to put your devices on the wire, you really need a special set of tools. You can use the everyday strippers and crimpers and try and do it, but then that's pretty tough if you want to meet ABYC standards, because they do have a standard for how many pounds you should be able to pull on a wire after it's crimped and not come apart. And if you don't use the proper crimper, it's probably not going to happen. So Anchor does make also a automatic adjustable wire stripper, so that you can strip the precise amount of insulation off the end, so that when you stick the wire into the sleeve on the spade or ring connector, that it's in far enough that when you crimp it, it will have plenty of grip, but it doesn't stick through the sleeve on the connector and interfere with trying to screw it down or plug it in with the spade. And then you also would want to get their double crimp ratchet tool, which crimps the sleeve on the conductor and the sleeve on the insulation in one operation. And it's a ratchet, which means that if you don't squeeze it tight enough to do it in the correct manner, it will not release from the wire. So if you use the tool properly, you will come out with a near perfect crimp every time.
Okay. Now, Anchor products, do they have a website, Carl?
Well, I think, you know, I should have looked that up, but I think if you Google Anchor, you'll come up with it quite readily.
Okay.
And
okay.
That's another company that has a lot of information. And they used to send you a catalog if you requested, so if you wanted some of those charts to look at for gauge sizes versus length and voltage drop and that kind of stuff, you could have it in the paper form. But I think it should be available on the Internet without a problem.
Okay. I might actually have you put together a list in the next few days of the different companies that you'd recommend products from. That would be helpful for everybody. And then I can look up the website addresses if they have them and include that too.
Okay.
That would probably be nice for everyone. So anyway,
mm-hmm.
for those of you out there wondering.
Yep. And well, another tool that Anker makes is like a battery cable stripper.
Mm-hmm.
And battery cable, because it's heavy and it has many, many light strands, and it's very difficult to cut or score the insulation off without cutting into some of the conductors. So mm-hmm. they have a little tool that works very nicely for that, and saves you from removing any of your little conductors, which you'd like to have in there.
Okay.
And they also have an anti-corrosion cream that you rub on your wire before you stick it into the connector and crimp it. And then we should probably mention you would also want some heat-lined or some adhesive-lined heat-shrink tubing. So you slip that on the wire first, then you crimp your terminal on the wire, which has been prepared with the anti-corrosion material, and then you slide the heat-shrink tubing over that connection, and they have a little mini torch that you use, or you could use maybe a heat gun, or pretty much any heat source, as long as you don't overdo it, will shrink that right down tight, and it makes a very nice, tight, waterproof connection. So, and we might mention, too, that for cutting heavier than like 12, 14-gauge wire battery cable and that, if you're going to do quite a few of them, you might want to invest in a Klein Tool cable cutter. It kind of looks like a landscaper's loper,
mm-hmm.
but it's the way it's shaped and designed is that it cuts all the wire cleanly, and it doesn't fold any over, and it doesn't cut it crooked. And that's pretty difficult to do with any other kind of cutting tool if you've got, you know, a large number of fine strands in a good-sized cable. So, but all of these details, which probably are now have got everybody sleeping or bored to death.
No.
If you want your electrical system to really work well and work for the life of the boat, this time is really well spent.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, I think it's very interesting. So, I'm sure that the guys are enjoying it. You're giving so much good information to do it right, and
mm-hmm.
That's what's important.
Yeah, and I guess probably I should mention also that, you know, even when if you're going to have a 110-volt system on your boat, they make special outlets for the marine environment, and they're very expensive, but they also are worth the money.
Okay.
And I will also say that once you have a starting battery and a house battery, like you have on any cabin boat, whether it's a sailboat or a motorboat, there always comes the problem of how you're going to charge two different banks of batteries at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And Blue Seas makes what they call an automatic charge relay, ACR for short, it's a battery link, that is adjustable for opening and closing voltage and cutout voltage. And what it does is it can connect all your two battery banks when the voltage comes up to the right amount to properly charge them. So if you're running a trolling motor or lights or fridge or whatever, and then you start up your engine and you start charging your starting battery, when the voltage gets high enough, this switch combines that with your house battery at a preset voltage, and then it continues to charge until they're fully charged.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get an over-voltage condition, it will also disconnect the two. So it makes it pretty handy. You don't have to keep remembering just whether you switched your battery switch to combine both banks or not. So
That's very nice. Okay.
Yes, and some people don't like relay type battery combiners, as I will call them. But here again, Blue Seas, they claim it's got a million cycle life, so they really test their stuff well, and it's ignition protected. So I really wouldn't have any problems with using that in the marine environment. And of course, mine's lasted 4 years with no problems so far. So.
Okay.
I think it's a good system.
Yeah. Very good. Well, what kind of electronic things do you have on your boat that you had?
Well, I have an autopilot.
Okay.
And I have a GPS, and I have what we used to refer to as a sum log, but it measures your speed and keeps track of your distance. And also we have a temperature sensor. and a depth sounder. And because I have a single station boat where you only steer from one place, even though it's quite a large boat, I only have one each of those. Sometimes people have more than one depth sounder.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have the speed log, so I can measure the over-the-water speed versus the GPS, which gives you over-the-bottom speed.
Okay.
So they don't necessarily have to be the same, and as you would know, because you live where there's tides and you're in the ocean, when you're battling the tide by going out, your over-the-ground speed's much slower than what your over-the-water speed is.
Right.
And then when you come back, you're going over the ground like 60s because you're going with the water when the tide's going in.
Mm-hmm.
So, and rivers give you the same function there. So,
okay.
Well, I think we've covered most of the details. I don't know if you want to have more detail than that, other than to tell you that you have to go and screw down the wire.
Okay, well, you know what? We got a few questions here, Carl.
Well,
let me ask a couple of these.
Sure.
Let's see. John wanted to know, do you solder all connections?
No. Soldering is not recommended.
Okay.
And the reason for that is if you're using a high-strand, fine-stranded cable, when you solder that, where the solder ends makes a hard spot.
Mm-hmm.
So that when the cable starts flexing, that's bending all of the strands where the solder stops, and that will cause early failure compared to having the proper crimp. And I will say, like for battery cables, Anker makes a rather rudimentary tool that you can use with a hammer or in a vise to set their battery lugs on the end of the cable, and that does work very, very well. But if you look at most of the battery lugs where the cable goes into the end that you're going to crimp, it's a little bit on the bell-shaped side,
mm-hmm.
so that when it's crimped and then you're bending the cable, there is not a hard edge for that to bend against. And that's why they really don't like soldering.
Okay.
And then, of course, if you're going to take it apart ever, you've got to cut some off because you really can't desolder it.
Okay. All right, another question from Ted. He says, is there a need to maintain space or shielding to segregate 12 VDC and 120 VAC wiring, for example, EMF and or stray currents? And number two, are separate ground systems required for 12 and 120?
That is an interesting question. I guess for as far as combining runs for 110 and 12 volt, if there might be an issue for that, I think I would do the research on your 12 volt things like your electronics and that, and see if there, because usually if there's going to be a problem, they will caution you when installing the runs to your 12 volt equipment to keep them away from 120.
Okay.
But we'll throw a little caveat in here. Unless you have a large boat with a generator, usually when you're out running your boat with the 12-volt stuff, all the 110 is dead. So, because if you don't have a generator, you have no way of generating that field and causing you a problem. And that is also a good way you could test that, is if after your installations are done with your 12-volt, you can plug in to the 120 and see if it causes interference, which is literally how most of that stuff has to be done, is by seat of the pants. So,
okay.
But as far as running, because you always are limited for space where you got to run cables. But as far as running them, say, within 2 or 3 inches of each other when you're going 4.5, there should be no problem with that. But I would, however, label that stuff so that you know what's 12 volt and what's the high voltage.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the wire I ran was what we call a duplex cable, which has the two insulated conductors and then an outside cover as well, kind of like household Romex wire. And that had a white jacket on it, so you could label right on there with a Sharpie, keep writing on there every so often what voltage was in there.
Mm-hmm.
So that whenever you look into a compartment and see wire, that you would know exactly what you have there.
Good idea.
And you're going to have to tell me, Gail, the second part of that question. Cause
Well, it says are separate ground systems required for 12 and 120.
Okay. The ground system is quite touchy, and that is quite a bit on the complicated side, and those three reference books that I mentioned will give you a wide overview of what to do for grounding. Now, there are three grounds, really, on a boat. There's grounding or bonding of all the underwater metal parts. Then you have a 12-volt ground, and then you have a 120-volt ground. But because of various issues with safety, ABYC standards require that if you have a 12-volt panel and a 120-volt panel, that somewhere in there you combine the ground bus bars of those two panels together so that you have a complete one ground wire when you're plugged into 120 volts.
Okay.
But that can cause some other issues with stray currents and stuff. So they also want you to put in what's called a galvanic isolator, which goes on the inside of the boat after the wire comes in from the connector on the outside of the hull. So when you plug into your 120 volt, then the ground goes to this isolator and then goes on to the main panel. So this keeps stray 12-volt currents from using the ground wire of any of your 120-volt system to, by electrolysis, destroy other parts of your boat underwater that are metal.
Okay.
So it's kind of hard here for me to explain that, and I don't know if I'm being clear or not, but you know, the system that you bond all your underwater metal parts together is also supposed to be combined into your 12-volt ground, like with the engine. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that sounds clear. Bob wants to know, is it necessary to install a double battery system in a runabout-sized craft like the Barrelback?
I would say not, unless you want the, you know, some people like these little, look like an ice chest, but they're really a refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
You plug them into a 12-volt if you want to do that, or if you want to play stereo and you want to go anchor out or beach it somewhere and play a lot of that stuff and then still have battery to start, it might not be a bad idea to have two. But
Okay. Normally
you would, in a runabout, you would probably just have the one battery system. And I guess we might mention a little more about batteries here, is they make pure starting batteries, they make pure deep cycle batteries, and they make batteries which are called combination starting deep cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And for an application like what he's talking about, I would put in, you know, a really large group 27 would be a deep cycle starting battery combination. So that you would have the punch to start, but could still have some ability to, you know, mess around during the day and listen to stereo and do other things that might use some electricity and still have available power for starting your engine.
Okay. All right. And Larry has a couple questions. Larry asks, why did you choose hydraulic over cable? And you already covered that because of the length of your boat, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And the autopilot issue.
Right.
So.
Okay, and then is your electric service panel a specially built marine unit?
Absolutely. That's where the Blue Sea stuff comes in. So, yeah. And
okay.
Let's
see. Did you add substantial flotation in your 50-footer? Kind of off topic, but.
Yeah. Well, no, I did not, because the regulations don't require any. And I am in a unique situation, is because my boat is a trawler speed boat. It cruises at 7 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have two huge engines in there that weigh, you know, 1,500 pounds apiece. I have a single 24 horsepower engine which weighs around 500 pounds.
Okay.
So the calculations done about the volume of wood that's in the boat and the partial air trapped in tanks that aren't always full,
mm-hmm.
and some other issues, I did not add any flotation to the boat other than what's there.
Okay.
But typically, if you're over 20 foot, you know, I guess they're assuming you're going to have a dinghy to jump into when the boat's going down. So you aren't required to put any flotation in by any law or rule.
Okay. All right. Well, anything else you want to cover about the electrical, or should we move on to the steering?
Well, I think we can move on to the steering.
Okay.
I probably forgot to tell you something about electrical.
Well, if anybody has a question, just, you know, feel free to type it. You just type it on the little system on the event page. There's a little box there you can type questions in. But, yeah. And you know what? Carl is always on the Boat Builder Forum, too. So if you do have questions about wiring, you know, obviously you should really check with the authorities that he's mentioned. But if you did have a quick question, I'm sure Carl would be happy to help you.
Yeah, through if they PM me, I could see what I can do. So,
okay. Well, yeah. let's move on to the steering then.
Okay.
Switch gears.
Mm-hmm. With the hydraulic steering, of course, you have probably the same issues with whether you're going to use push-pull cable or any of the others. You have to decide what you're going to use at the helm. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the size of the pump that is necessary to move the size of your rudder at the desired speed and effort. And that's one of the things, like I used material from Vetus Marine, and they used to sell direct, but now you have to buy through marine dealers. But I have not been to their website lately, but they had a very nice tool on there for boats like mine where you have a large rudder that's measured in square feet and not square inches,
mm-hmm.
that you could calculate the load that it was going to take to turn your rudder effectively. And that their tool takes into account whether the rudder's balanced. That means part of it is ahead of the pivot point and part of it's behind the pivot point, or whether it's unbalanced.
Mm-hmm.
So what you want, how fast and effortlessly you want to move that square footage of rudder is what determines how big your helm pump should be, because you have to move a certain amount of fluid in a certain amount of time to do it. And then the other thing is, how big of a hydraulic cylinder do you need to turn that rudder? And that also, you have to know the length of the tiller, which is attached to the rudder. Because the distance from the pivot point to the end of the tiller, the longer that is, the easier it is to turn. But most cylinders have a pretty limited travel distance. So if you have an 8-inch travel distance, you can't have a 2-foot tiller on your rudder. It's got to be much shorter. So that's some of the stuff you have to consider when you're starting out with the hydraulic. And your helm pump should, in my opinion, be a non-reversing or a no-feedback system, because then when you take your hand off the wheel, it stays there. And you can, if you're going to have two stations, if they're both non-reversing or no-feedback, you can turn either station and steer, and the other one doesn't do anything when you're not touching it. And that also applies if you want to use an autopilot, that the pump can run and steer the boat and the wheel doesn't move. And if you are an autopilot and you want to avoid something, you can override the autopilot by steering with the wheel, although you have to be fast.
Okay.
So one thing I would mention about mounting in any kind of steering is that your helm station be mounted very, very securely, and especially in faster boats, because you're really hanging on there pretty good and getting tossed around, so you want all of that to be very solidly mounted.
Mm-hmm.
And the same for your... In the rear of the boat at the rudder, you want your hydraulic steering to be, your cylinder to be very solidly mounted and through bolted, so that it can't possibly work loose. And then I guess we need to talk about how you would run lines for your hydraulic steering.
Okay, let me interrupt you real quick. What system did you use on your boat?
Vetus Marine.
Okay, that's what it's called. And how do you spell that?
Yep. I think it's Vetus. And that's a Dutch firm.
Okay.
and they used to have a big warehouse in Baltimore, and I don't know if it's still there or not.
Okay.
Boy, you're on this kind of stuff. You're asking me some hard questions. If you could see the piles in my office here. I'm looking around for this stuff, and it's in here, but that, I can't see it. But yeah, I chose that over the Teleflex and the other systems. The Vetus, and I don't know if their equipment is exactly the same now or not, but I would check because I wanted a system with my helm pump has pistons in it, so that when you rotate it, the wheel, little pistons are pushing the oil. And Teleflex and some of the others, they're what's called a vane system. I don't understand exactly how they work, but I like the feel of the piston pump better.
Okay.
And I think it is, you know, a little more rugged and long-lasting. And I will mention that the Vetus pump is not a pressurized system. Most of the Teleflex stuff, somewhere in the system, you have to install a fluid tank that is under usually a low pressure, like 10 or 15 pounds, to keep oil in the system from, you know, getting bubbly and foamy, and that'll work properly. In the Vetus system, you put the oil in the pump at the helm, and there's a vented plug that closes it up so it runs under atmospheric pressure. So I think that's a plus, because if you do develop a leak, you're not going to lose the system right away because you've got pressurized oil that's going to squirt out and be gone.
Hmm.
So as far as lines to get the hydraulic fluid from your helm pump to your cylinder, they used to use a lot of copper, and copper can be pretty tough to route. And if you could route it, it would have to be mounted with metal strap that's got a rubber sleeve in it.
Mm-hmm.
And probably at pretty tight intervals, probably a foot apart, so that you get no movement. Because if copper, here again, if copper bends enough times, it will fracture and leak. And also, when you get to the end of your copper run, where it hooks onto the cylinder, because the cylinder does move slightly while it's pushing the teller in and out, you have to have some kind of a flexible high-pressure rubber hose or tubing at the end of the copper to connect to the cylinder, so that you're not applying that constant small movement to the copper and cause it to fatigue.
Okay.
The other system you can get, some of them have, which is like a rubber hose, which has a couple of braided reinforcement layers in it, and those are made up with a special crimped fitting on the end, but those you usually, you know, you have to order them special, and they're made exactly to the length you need.
Okay.
Then there was the third system, which is the one I use, which Vetus has, which I think is pretty nifty as far as you being able to fix it in the field, and it had a nylon or plastic tubing that was about 10 millimeters inside diameter or 3/8 of an inch.
Mm-hmm.
It has a very tough nylon inner tube. And then there's fabric on the outside of that and a very tough nylon covering on the outside of that. And their fittings are made up of brass, and they're about 2 inches long, and it has a large nut, which you put on the outside of this nylon tubing with a left-hand thread. You screw it on counterclockwise, and you screw that on until just a certain amount of the tube sticks out. Then you screw the other part of the fitting inside the tubing, and then you rotate the nut that you turned on left hand. You turn it on the other way and tighten it to the fitting that you inserted on the inside of the tube. And the two made up in a manner similar to a flare joint, but not really. But it really holds on,
mm-hmm.
and it's a very nice leak-tight unit, and it's something that you can do in the field if you had develop the leak or you damaged one of the tubes somehow, that you could make the repair on your boat and not have to order special replacement hose, or a copper could be repaired also, but you'd have to have flare tube fittings and the tools to do that. So, and for larger boats like mine, which have quite a big rudder, you really need to allow for if the pump breaks, or something else happens and you can't steer the boat anymore. Mm-hmm. I have an emergency tiller that's 6 feet long that hooks onto the top of the rudder post because my rudder is on the outside of the transom or an outboard rudder. Mm-hmm. So you can set the tiller on the top of the rudder, and then you can steer from the cockpit. But in order to do that, if something is wrong with your hydraulic system and you can't turn stuff, then it's locked up.
Yeah.
So the only way you could then steer is if you have a bypass valve, which allows fluid to pass back and forth between the two lines. And so that would be an emergency type device that you might want to install. And I certainly did, so that if something did happen, you can set your bypass valve, put your emergency tiller on, and you can at least steer mm-hmm. to safety. Now, if you're running your boat mostly on smaller lakes and you can always see the shore, that's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're, like me, outside of land a lot, it's the bigger deal.
Sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, I didn't mention anything about rudders, and for rudders the size of mine, I guess I should mention about the pintles and gudgeons that you, or the hinges that rudders use, that you make those, get some nice bronze ones that are good and heavy duty. And a lot of times a big rudder has a heel bearing, which is at the very bottom of the rudder between the skeg and the rudder, and that you'd want to have very robust material and hopefully be something like 316L stainless, which is pretty inert to electrolysis. And then, of course, you'd want to have some things bolted to those to help mitigate any electrolysis, and also have a way when you're out of the water in your annual inspection, or if you take it out for winter, that you can grease that bearing so that it always stays loose and steerable. And I guess that's about what I have for that.
All right. Well, we got a couple questions.
Good.
Let's see. Fleather, I think I'm saying that right, says, how about routing the hoses through rigging tubes under deck? Base star under 150 horsepower, C star for larger horsepower, multiple engines, and dual helms.
How about running those through like
rigging,
a conduit?
Rigging tubes and under deck.
Yeah, rigging tube would be, well, it's probably PVC pipe or something of that nature. Mm-hmm. I think that would be fine.
Okay.
That would be fine to run through there because that's very nice and smooth, and that supports it enough that you're not really, you know, I wouldn't stick it in a great big pipe where it can flop around a lot, but
mm-hmm.
I'm not real familiar with that base star, C star line composition. But
okay.
I would think that it would certainly be possible. You might want to contact the manufacturer. I'm sure they would have somebody on staff that could tell you about that for sure.
Yeah. Okay, and Chris in New Smyrna Beach wants to know if you have any lightning protection on board.
Well, that is a... I wasn't going to cover lightning because that's a real sack of worms. No, I do not have lightning protection.
Okay.
And I possibly should explain why that is. I have boated on the Great Lakes for, well, almost as long as Gail's been alive. And I've unfortunately been able to see several boats that have been lightning damaged.
Oh.
And there's all kinds of devices they want to sell you, from these little spiny porcupine things on a wire you put at the top of your mast, and the big cable goes down and you know, you bond it to the keel, or you have a big strap you throw over the side, or you bond it to a big copper plate on the bottom of your boat. There's any number of these things.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I've seen, this is my personal experience, none of it really helps.
Oh.
Lightning's just going to pick you off when it's going to pick you off. But the one thing I have noticed in the places where boats are in marinas and parked in lightning strikes,
mm-hmm.
that quite often the damage is far worse to the boats that are 2, 3, 4, and 5 boats away from the one that struck than it is at the one that struck.
Really?
So,
okay.
Yes, it jumps, and that's why lightning is so hard to combat. mm-hmm. is because you've got this lovely thing at the top of the mast, you've got this cable as big as your thumb going right down to the water, and the lightning jumps sideways to the next boat and blows the cabin apart.
Right.
So, it's totally unpredictable. And so, you know, if you do all the research and read all about it and you decide it's a good idea, I guess it probably can't hurt. So,
yeah.
But, you know, from what I've seen, it really makes no difference whether you've got it or you haven't. So.
Okay. Well, Lester has a question. I'm not sure if you answered this. It says, if I built a houseboat, do I need one 10-volt system, or can I adjust it all to run 12-volt and use a battery bank and solar charger for the battery?
Well, that certainly is possible. But if you're going to do your houseboat with only 12-volt, you're going to have like a little refrigerator mm-hmm. and stuff like that, you really have to pick your stuff carefully. I picked an isotherm refrigerator, which has a very low amp draw, so that does help. But you're also limited on size, because if you get a big two-door refrigerator like they have in an RV that's 6-7 cubic foot, mm-hmm. then it's going to burn 3 amps an hour. So, you know, over a 24-hour period, that's a couple of fat batteries depleted.
Yeah.
And so if you're going to, you know, the solar thing certainly can work fine, especially if you have plenty of sun in your area. And without getting too far into that, the solar cells come basically in two types. One type puts out a lot more electricity in full sun, but it cannot be shaded. If it gets shaded anywhere on the panel, it shuts down because of the way the cells are wired.
Okay.
Then there's the other solar panel that can take some shade, but it doesn't put out as much, but the shade doesn't shut it down. But the thing is, what you need to do is calculate the total amp draw that you're going to use and see how many amp hours of electricity you need in a day, and then you have to have the right number of solar cells to combat that, to recharge your battery. And typically, you know, if you've got a 27 by 54-inch solar cell, you may need 10 of them mm-hmm. on the roof of your houseboat in order to get enough electricity to run all your stuff and keep your batteries going. And that may be a problem, putting that many up there, as far as it takes up all the space. And, of course, it would cost into the thousands.
Yeah, really. And weight would be an issue, too, I'm sure.
Yep.
Okay. Very good. Well, you know, I just want to thank you, Carl, so much for all your information. I'm not an expert on either of these subjects at all. I'm not knowledgeable on either one, but I found it very interesting, and I really appreciate that you gave us, you know, you gave the guys the right way to do things and, you know, not cutting corners, recommending that, you know, they use the marine materials and such, because that's
right.
important. So I think that was very helpful, and I hope you
right.
guys enjoyed it too. We really appreciate your time, because I know, you know, Carl didn't just pick up the phone and start talking. He's been thinking about this and planning what he was going to say and for a long time. So we really appreciate this, Carl. It's
well, you're welcome.
Extremely helpful. So, and I did want everybody to know. Well, like I mentioned, we'll try to put together some type of a resource list that we can email out to everybody. I'd like to have that, too. It would be a nice resource to have on our website somewhere,
mm-hmm.
you know, just so people, because that's one issue a lot of people do ask about wiring, and we pretty much just, you know, we have some of the books you mentioned on our website for sale.
Yes.
And we pretty much
yep.
just refer them to those.
Right, and those are excellent texts.
Yeah.
But it can be pretty dry reading, but you know, a lot of boat building is research,
right?
Especially on a cabin boat. So that time really pays off.
Yeah. Well, very good. Well, thank you again, and I think our time's up. But I did want to let everybody know on the call that I do have another teleseminar planned, and in fact, he's on the line here somewhere. John Wilmot. He's in Maryland, and he's going to be talking to us about building his Outrage, which is a 16-foot deep V ski boat. It's a plywood constructed boat, and John has put together a PowerPoint presentation, so we can kind of follow along, and you can see photos of his boat, and he'll talk to us and tell us all about that. He did a beautiful job, and if you wanted to look at his pictures, he is in the customer photos section too. There's a couple photos of his finished boat, so that'll be the date we've set. Tentatively is, oh golly, I didn't write it down. The 23rd of June, June 23rd. So, and I think that's a Tuesday also, and it'll be at the same time. So mark it on your calendar, and I'll send out our notices like we do. So anyway, thank you, everybody, for joining us. Again, Carl, thank you so much.
And you're welcome.
Everybody have a wonderful evening. And we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Okay.